name is Bill Denman. I'm chief of the Redevelopment and Chemicals Branch in EPA Region 4, also on a temporary assignment to our EPA headquarters to work on the Superfund redevelopment program. So for those of you who have tuned into some of these Superfund redevelopment webinars over the past few years, you may have heard me speak on Superfund redevelopment. I've worked in the Superfund program for many, many years and as a project manager, as a manager, but all of that time being involved in the redevelopment of Superfund sites, and certainly am excited to talk today about the role that opportunity zones and the opportunity zone advantages can help encourage redevelopment of Superfund sites. So we're so glad that you could join us. EPA Superfund redevelopment webinars share valuable reuse information, success stories, as well as challenges, with the hope that this information will inspire you to consider reuse on impaired and or remediated properties. Each webinar provides guidance, tools, and lessons to learn to support the successful reuse of Superfund sites. So if this is your first time to tune in for one of these webinars, please go back to the CLUM website and take a look at some of the archived webinars. There's a lot of good information about redeveloping Superfund sites and contaminated property in general. So to kick us off, I will be providing a brief introduction of the Superfund redevelopment program and opportunity zones as it relates to Superfund sites for those of you who may not be familiar with the Superfund redevelopment program. Then following my presentation, we'll hear from Brad Carney, who will be discussing the nuts and bolts of opportunity zones. And then Matt Ward will talk to us specifically about opportunity zones as they relate to local governments and how local governments can be involved. And last but certainly not least, John Grosshans, who is our EPA Region 5 Opportunity Zone Coordinator, is going to share with us the many tools and resources for opportunity zones. And most of what I know about opportunity zones I learned from John, so I'm always excited to hear him speak on this topic. And John, thank you as well as all of the speakers for being willing to share your expertise with us this afternoon. So as Gene said, I'll do a short wrap-up after John's presentation, and then we'll be sure to leave time at the end for any questions that you might have. So before we talk about opportunity zones specifically, I'd like to take a few minutes to introduce EPA's Superfund redevelopment program, something that's very near and dear to my heart, and I've worked in since the late 90s when this was just an initiative and not part of Superfund's mission. So I've seen it grow from just kind of a concept into being a real part of what the EPA Superfund program is about as we conduct cleanups. The EPA Superfund redevelopment program out of headquarters supports EPA staff and works with communities and other partners to consider future use opportunities and then integrate appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. We have lots and lots of examples of where this has been done successfully across the country, and I would encourage you to visit our Superfund redevelopment website. We've done a lot of fact sheets, a lot of success stories and case studies on those different types of successes that we've had. It's important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There are many ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there certainly is no one-size-fits-all solution at a Superfund site to determine which reuse type will be most appropriate. If any of you have been involved with a Superfund cleanup, you know no two sites are the same, no two communities are the same, and what they need and how they can be put into beneficial use for the community is different for every site. The redevelopment of Superfund sites pose unique challenges in terms of protectiveness, stigma, and liability protections. However, they also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. So it's important to know, for those of you in the business probably certainly know this, but if you, in case you're not aware, EPA doesn't own sites in the Superfund program or control land use. In very, very rare cases, EPA may own some property, but you know, really we're not set up for that, and it's not how EPA approaches cleanup. And certainly local land use is controlled at the local zoning level, either city councils, county commissioners, board of supervisors, and organizations like that at the local level control land use. But helping to return contaminated sites to productive use and to be beneficial for the communities is important for communities, and it's an important part of EPA's mission. It's kind of the why we spend all the time and effort cleaning up sites. We want to make sure that we can help communities, developers, local governments overcome the obstacles that they may face because of it being a Superfund site to be able to put it back into beneficial use. And so to do this, we've developed a wide array of tools and resources and support for local governments, communities, developers, and EPA regional staff to use on these sites. And just to let you know, these photos at the top are from the Libby asbestos site in Libby, Montana. So I'd like to start with the big picture. As redevelopment and chemicals branch chief in Region 4, I also work with the brownfields program. And so I'm sure many of you on the call know this, but there are certainly more brownfields across the country than any other type of contaminated or potentially contaminated properties. I think EPA's initial estimate in the mid-90s was 450,000, and that's still our estimate of the number of brownfields in the country. I don't think that's changed. Some people estimate that as high as 600,000. Many of these also include underground storage tank issues, or sometimes there are just underground storage tank issues at sites, which is also a large number of contaminated properties out there. But about 40,000 sites have been impacted by the Superfund program. About 1,600 of those are sites that are on the national priorities list, and so a lot of times that's what people think of when they think of Superfund. But there's also a large number, about 38,000, that have been impacted or cleaned up or addressed by our EPA removal program. There are also about 6,400 RCRA corrective action sites out there that also can take some of these same concepts and put them into play as far as planning for future use. And of course, for Superfund, both removal and National Priorities List sites can be and are successfully redeveloped. The reason, I think this is important and it really hit home with me is when I saw the statistic that over half of the U.S. population lives within 3 miles of at least one of these types of sites. So it certainly impacts a lot of people in the United States. So why is this part of EPA's missions, and what are the benefits of reuse at Superfund sites? The benefits to local governments, and for those of you who are familiar with the triple bottom line or the three-legged stool or, the concepts of sustainability, you know that you need to consider the economic, the environmental, and the social impacts of a cleanup or of an action like this in order to truly be a sustainable action. So the benefits to local governments and communities include creating jobs, which can and also increasing the tax base by now having a property that may have a negative value to having a normal value like other properties of its type, and therefore will pay property taxes on it. It helps revitalize neighborhoods, and it helps restore a sense of community by bringing housing, retail, recreation, or ecosystem services. I know I had a site in Central Georgia that we gave an award to for the redevelopment that happened, and I went down with the project manager who had worked on it years before, and he noticed how the community had just taken so much more pride in their community and the houses and everything. Just he said it just looks better, and people look are more proud of this neighborhood because this site, which had been an abandoned wood treater, was now a regional soccer field, and so people from several counties around came because it was one of the few areas that kids could play soccer in the area, and it certainly had a benefit just in the sense of community of the people that lived around it. It was obvious they were proud of this. Redevelopment also benefits EPA by bringing certainty to anticipated land use with a new owner who will be a good steward of the site. In some cases, these new owners even will be willing to take on part of the cleanup or enhance the cleanup, and these are things that we've done successfully at many sites across the country. Just from an environmental, just a basic environmental standpoint, George Washington University did a study that showed that for every acre of contaminated property that gets redeveloped, on average, about 4.5 acres of greenfields are preserved just because of the urban sprawl phenomenon. So there are certainly many, many reasons to get these sites cleaned up and put back into beneficial use. And some people, local governments, community members, developers, even people at EPA, I've heard many, many times that they think, well, the site's being cleaned up by Superfund. Once it's deleted from the national priorities list, it can be put into redevelopment. And this is not true. It doesn't have to be deleted from the NPL. In fact, the earlier EPA can identify the end use, the developer, the anticipated future land use, the better our cleanup can be designed to support that. Many sites can be and are reused during the cleanup process. So EPA and local governments and developers can coordinate during cleanups to maximize cleanup and reuse. So for example, planned parking lots can be used as caps for contamination, or we may locate monitoring wells to allow for better reuse of the property and prevent it from blocking whatever is being considered for use. And it's also, like I said before, it's also possible for the prospective purchaser to take on part of the cleanup, maybe in exchange for EPA for giving part of a lien or something like that, so that they can meet their timeline for getting their development in place. The bottom line is EPA has lots of tools, resources, and support that we can use to help local governments, community members, and developers who want to get these sites back into beneficial use. I always like to throw in a couple of examples, and here's just a couple of many that we have. We have redevelopments that include government offices, shopping centers, manufacturing facilities, affordable housing, recreational fields, like I mentioned before, ecological preserves, and many, many other types of reuse. And we have Humane Society located. We have all kinds of really cool types of reuse that sites have been put back into. These are just a couple. On the left, that's the South Carolina Aquarium, which is on the Calhoun Park area Superfund site in Charleston, South Carolina. So if any of you have ever been to Charleston, you've been to the aquarium, it's on a Superfund site. And that building just to the right is a National Park Service building. And so if you've ever been to Fort Sumter, that's where you left from. Both of those are on property that's part of the Calhoun Park Superfund site, which was an old manufactured gas plant, which all of the old cities, especially in the South, have these. That's where they took coal and extracted natural gas from it to power street lamps and different power back at the late 1800s, early 1900s, mainly late 1800s, I believe. It's so great to go somewhere, see the cleanup is still operating there, a cleanup system is cleaning up the groundwater, but then we have these wonderful reuses there that are great economic activity for Charleston and also for the public. Let's see, let me get back on my slide here. Okay. All right. And on the right there, you can see this is the Midvale Slag Superfund site in Midvale, Utah. This is the CHG healthcare complex on the Midvale Slag Superfund site in Midvale. It was formerly used as a landfill and ore smelter and refinery. And there's just an entire community built on the Midvale Slag site. It's certainly one worth checking out if you're interested in this kind of thing on our website, because it's just a wonderful success story. So that gets us to today's topic, which are opportunity zones. So what are opportunity zones? Well, I'm certainly the least qualified to talk about this, but I just wanted to give a very broad overview of this and as it relates to Superfund site redevelopment. So Brad Carney, as an opportunity zone tax law expert, is going to talk much more detail about nuts and bolts. But like I said, we're just going to go over some big picture stuff here. The purpose of opportunity zones was to attract private investment to revitalize economically distressed communities. Opportunity zones were first conceptualized during the Obama administration, and then legislation was created through a bipartisan congressional effort and signed into law by President Trump in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So this is a concept that has wide bipartisan support and has been very successful at attracting investment to these underserved and areas that desperately need it. In early 2018, each state governor was asked to designate the opportunity zones in their states, so they were designated by the state governors. And as this map shows, 8,756 opportunity zones were established in all 50 states, D.C., and in six of the U.S. territories. Opportunity zones are a huge tax benefit. In fact, they've been called a once-in-a-lifetime tax benefit opportunity for investors. Treasury is anticipating they will attract as much as $100 billion to be invested in lower-income neighborhoods. So for those of you not that familiar with opportunity zones yet, this is a huge deal. And to the extent this applies to help get sites like Superfund sites, brownfields, and sites that are impacted by contamination back into productive use, we're very excited about that potential. So specific to this webinar, they're a perfect fit for Superfund sites. Superfund sites, more than any other type of contaminated sites, are burdened with stigma, which cause investors, developers, and local governments to be cautious about getting involved with them. It's something that we've been working against for over 20 years now, is to address this stigma and what a lot of these tools are designed to do that we've developed over the years. So therefore, these opportunity zone incentives are really important to attract private party investment to help get them over that initial concern about liability. They help close the gap to make projects pencil out and help make them profitable, which, as we all know, once they're profitable and once people are going to make money on them, then you really start getting some momentum about getting a project moving forward. There are 343 Superfund National Priority List sites located in or partially in Opportunity Zones across the nation. It's estimated that there are thousands of removal sites. So many cities and redevelopment authorities are developing websites and brochures to market these properties to Opportunity Zone investors. And one lesson that we've learned so far is that it's easier, that the easier local governments and EPA can make it for investors to understand the Opportunity Zone in-site reuse, the more sites will get redeveloped. And it really is a perfect fit for Superfund sites. It fits squarely in the Superfund Task Force, if you're familiar with the Superfund Task Force report, which I was fortunate enough to help participate in developing. They had five goals, and goal three was encouraging private investment to promote redevelopment. And so, you know, there were several specifics under that, but this is squarely in the, to fit squarely into, you know, the idea of trying to encourage private investment to speed up cleanups. Their Opportunity Zones are a terrific tool because they can attract private investment and can help redevelopment projects be more profitable. And the great news is most Superfund sites should be eligible for this benefit. Let's see. Okay. So why do we care about Opportunity Zones? Well, by most measures of socioeconomic well-being, Opportunity Zones are among the highest, or among the highest need communities across the U.S., and have a potential positive impact on economically distressed communities. It's such a big deal because Opportunity Zones cover 10% of the U.S. land mass. 23% are in rural areas, and the communities in Opportunity Zones suffer double the national poverty rate. Opportunity Zones contain about a third of all identified brownfield sites, about a third of all federal national priorities list sites, and thousands of Superfund removal sites. For these communities, Opportunity Zones can help revitalize contaminated and formerly contaminated properties, attract private investment, and are designed to specifically strengthen the financial viability of redevelopment projects. So the map here is showing an Opportunity Zone in Butte, Montana. A large portion of the Silver Bow Creek Butte area Superfund site is located within this Opportunity Zone, which opens up a lot of funding opportunities for redevelopment. So with that said, and the introduction now to why Superfund sites, why this is such a big deal to help promote Superfund redevelopment, I'm going to turn it over to Brad Carney, who's going to share more detailed information about the nuts and bolts and how this would work. So, Brad, take it away.
Bill, thank you very much. This is a first for me in the sense that my computer has completely crashed. So I'm actually running blind. I'm not able to see any of the slides. So Gene is there. Can you just confirm that the first slide, Purpose of Opportunity Zone, is on the screen?
Well, Brad, I can tell you Jean is always there, and she does have it up. And go ahead and get started. I sympathize with you. I've had this happen to me before. just keep going, and she'll make sure that the slides are all there like you want it. So just say next slide, or you know, if you want to know a particular one, let her know, and we'll make sure that it's on there.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Bill, Gene. So as Bill has previously stated, that the purpose of Opportunity Zones is to seek to encourage economic growth and investment in designated distressed communities. It was established as part of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It was statute itself is divided into two sections. The first section is 1400Z1, which was really the designation process using 2010 census data for the states designated by the governors of each state, and they were certified by the Department of Treasury. And the second section, which is really the focus of the presentation today, is the statute that governs qualified opportunity funds. By the way, I am Brad Carney. I'm a partner at the law firm of Marazzini Falcon, and our firm is based in New Jersey. So, Gene, next slide. This next slide should show market development that has been accelerating rapidly. It's a slide that was put out by the Economic Innovation Group. They are a bipartisan public policy organization. And what is remarkable about this chart is after two rounds of draft regulations, the final regulations that were adopted by the Department of Treasury became effective on March 13, 2020, just at the time that the pandemic was hitting. And this chart shows, basically, notwithstanding the pandemic, that there has been $75 billion of investment from May to the end of December, 70% of which was included as investment that would not have happened without the incentive. Gene, the next slide should also show an activity map that the Economic Innovation Group has put together. This is actually a terrific map. It filters by activity type, market category, theme. You can go right onto this interactive map. You can click and you can zoom into some of the details, the activities with respect to a particular fund or investment within an opportunity zone. Gene, the next slide, I'm going to be partial to New Jersey, shows the interactive mapping in New Jersey. The state of New Jersey has actually put up an opportunity zone marketplace, and it also has very similar mapping tools with overlay capability. Gene, the next slide is a slide on how opportunity zones work, and I call this the four Qs. Each Q is for qualified. So number one, you have to have qualifying capital. What is that? The qualifying capital is only, it's capital gains. So, and those capital gains have to be invested within a qualified opportunity fund within 180 days from recognizing the gain. Now, there is, because of the pandemic, there is a recent IRS notice, specifically it's 2021-10, and that basically says that in the last day of the 180-day investment period within which a taxpayer must make an investment in a qualified opportunity fund in order to satisfy the 180-day investment requirement, if that falls on or after April 1st of last year through March 31st of this year, then the last day of that 180-day investment period is postponed to March 31st. So it's recognizing capital gains from April 1st through the present can still be deposited into a qualified opportunity fund, and that will count even though that was more than 180 days from the recognized gain. The next Q is the qualified intermediary. That is actually the qualified opportunity fund. That can either be a corporation or a partnership. It's establishing by filing a form known as 8996 with the IRS with the federal tax return. The next Q is the qualifying activities, and this is either acquiring property or building or substantial improvement structures, or an original use that commences with the qualified opportunity fund, which I'm going to focus on later in this presentation. So think of that as property, and the other way is new shares of a qualifying business, where the fund buys shares of stock or partnership interest in an ongoing business within a qualified opportunity zone. And as Bill had pointed out previously, there are a number of 2010 census tracts that that became qualified opportunity zones in the United States, plus all of its territories. Gene, the next slide. The next slide should show the tax benefits, and there are three. One is the actual deferral of the capital gain that's invested. So there is no tax paid on the capital gain. It's deferred until December 31st, 2026. That would be paid on April 15th of 2027 at whatever the tax rate is established by the IRS in April 15th of 2027. That's the first tax benefit. The second is a step up in basis of the, so you get a step up in basis if the qualified opportunity fund holds the investment, the property, if you will, for 5 years or longer. That's a 10%, step up in basis. If you were able to go back in time, you get another 5% if it holds 7 years or longer. This holding period is before the deferral ends on December 31st of 2026. And then the last benefit, which is the most important, is that the actual appreciation of the property itself, zero federal capital gains tax on the sale of that property if it's held at least after 10 years, and notwithstanding the fact that all the opportunity zones will expire automatically in the year 2028, the Qualified Opportunity Fund actually has all the way through 2047 to divest itself of the property in order to receive zero federal capital gains tax on the appreciation of the property itself if it was held for 10 years or longer. That's a big incentive. Gene, the next slide. Next slide defines what a qualified opportunity fund is, and it is either a corporation or a partnership. It has to invest in a qualified opportunity zone, and it must hold at least 90% of its assets. And here's the big definition here, qualified opportunity zone property. What is that? There's two types. One is either a stock or partnership in a qualified opportunity zone business, or two, a qualified opportunity zone business property. We're going to focus more on the property aspect than an actual business. Gene, the next slide should show what the definition of a qualified opportunity zone business is. That is where substantially all of the property owned or leased by the taxpayer in the qualified opportunity business property, you have at least 50% of the total gross income is derived from active conduct of that business. A substantial portion is actually used in the actual active conduct of the business. And then there's this last requirement that 5% of the average aggregate unadjusted bases of the property is attributable to non-qualified financial property. There are certain sin businesses that don't count: golf courses, country clubs, massage parlors, hot tub facilities, suntan facilities, racetracks, gambling facilities, and liquor stores. None of those would ever qualify. Gene, the next slide should show the definition of a qualified opportunity zone property. The first two that are listed there are the businesses. I want to skip past that, Gene. So the next slide should show what the definition of a qualified opportunity zone business property is. And that is real property that's acquired by the fund, the Qualified Opportunity Fund, after December 31st, 2017. And this is really the focus sort of this seminar, is that the original use, there's a distinction here, the original use of the property commences with the fund, or you substantially improve the property. The substantial improvement, unfortunately, has a 30-month clock that runs from the date of acquisition, meaning that you need to double the basis, your improvement needs to double the basis of the property within 30 months after acquisition. I will say, because of the pandemic, the IRS has extended certain deadlines to March 31st of the end of this month, I should say. But what's important here is that EPA recognized during the public comment period that the 30-month window was completely unrealistic for brownfield properties because they take longer than traditional vertical development projects due to the challenge of contamination. And so during the public comment period before Department of Treasury, the request was to put brownfields within the original use category because original use doesn't have a time frame. And during the last round, the regulations that came out define original use that commences with the Qualified Opportunity Fund to mean that it has not been depreciated or amortized by the taxpayer other than the Qualified Opportunity Fund. But the big takeaway is that there's not a clock that runs with it. It's not a 30-month clock, so it's much more compatible for brownfields-type development. The rub, however, came that when the regulations came out, they said that a brownfield site is defined to mean, however, a brownfield is defined under CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act of 1980. The definition of a brownfield under CERCLA specifically excludes national priority list NPL Superfund sites from that definition. Gene, if I could have the next slide, this should say Acme Superfund site at the top. Just as an example, if you have a property remediation firm that purchases a Superfund site on property in a qualified opportunity zone where a former factory was once located, to remediate the land and use the property for affordable housing, I want to just stop right there. That would qualify as original use because it's not a same use that was used before. However, it would also count as substantial improvement if you're able to meet the 30-month tight time frame. But in addition, in conversations that we had with EPA over the summer, we also came to the conclusion that you could also meet the definition of original use if the Superfund site itself is defined as vacant property. Gene, the next slide. And actually, the next slide probably says significant improvement test. I just want to skip that in the interest of time because I've already really spoken about it. So the next slide after that should say commencement of original use of vacant property. One is if the property was vacant prior to the qualified opportunity zone designation in 2018 and remained vacant for at least a year before the qualified opportunity fund purchased the property. There's probably less of those, but more so, Gene, if you flip to the next slide, the other definition of a vacant property is after the designation of a qualified opportunity zone, if the qualified opportunity fund purchases it and it had been vacant for an uninterrupted 3-calendar-year period beginning after the date of the QOZ designation, so 3 years after 2018, and continuous vacancy up to the time that the fund purchases the property. Gene, the next slide probably has a bullet point that talks about original use. I just want to skip that in the interest of time. So the next slide should have a bullet point with the word vacancy. Vacancy under the regulations is defined as either real property, which includes land or buildings, if the building or land was significantly unused. That's defined to mean more than 80% of the building or land as measured by the square footage of usable space is currently not being used. And Gene, the last slide I have should have a heading local governments and original use. There's under the OZ regulations, a purchaser of real property from a local government who held the property as a result of, say, an involuntary transfer that could be through bankruptcy or foreclosure, can treat all the property composing the real property, including the land and structures, as satisfying the original use requirement. So that's another way to get into original use. And I was excited to see that the final regulations allowed for brownfield type properties and the ability to get Superfund sites also in under original use, because that should allow investors to say, hey, there's not as much of a risk to try to meet a 30-month substantial improvement test. So with that, Matt is our next speaker. And so Matt, I will ask you just to take it away from here.
Wonderful. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Good morning. Good to be with you and with good friends at EPA and other leading practitioners on this webcast about the opportunity now for communities at contaminated sites brought on by this great tax incentive, the Opportunity Zone program. So I'm Matt Ward. I am the CEO of the firm Sustainable Strategies DC. We're a firm in Washington that helps local governments get resources for revitalization, including at brownfields and CERCLA sites and RCRA sites and other contaminated lands across the nation. So I'm going to talk with you about the opportunities for communities. I'm mostly speaking to local governments, but I hope and think that my information is going to be useful to all the other folks that are on the program today. So I'm going to go ahead and proceed with a quick overview of the presentation. So I'm going to talk about really three things. First of all, I just want to talk about what a tremendous opportunity we have now, not only because of opportunity zones, but because of a lot of other resources that can be leveraged together with these opportunity funds. Next, I'm going to talk about some of the specific ways that opportunity zones provide a major tool for investment at contaminated sites. I'm not going to go over it in the great deal that Brad, our tax law expert, or Bill, our EPA lead, already went over, but I am going to highlight some of those points there. And then third, I'm going to give you some practical steps for what you do when you have a CERCLA site or another contaminated land within your community and you want to secure those opportunity fund investments to create redevelopment and revitalization in your community and at that site. So I'm going to talk about some of the key ways that we see people using opportunity fund investments for revitalization of contaminated land. I'm very much going to talk about what you need to do to get shovel ready and investment ready. And they're not the same thing, but they go hand in hand. I'm going to talk about how you can make the pitch to opportunity fund managers and investors. And then I will close out talking a little bit about ways that you can find those investors and find the opportunity funds that are out there. So, revitalizing what is idled. We all know what is idled. 1 year ago today, Friday, March 13th, my animation, I knew, over the web, maybe the animation wouldn't work. I'm going to try again. But 1 year ago today, all right, it's going crazy. I'm just going to talk. 1 year ago today, we were brought low by the virus. I don't know if somebody else is advancing because it is just advancing. So sorry about that. And this was my most comic timing slide of all of them. So I'm going to go back and try again. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But I am not advancing it. It's just advancing on its own. Okay. We all know by now that 1 year ago today, Friday, the 13th of March, 2020, we were brought low by the virus. Our nation was idled. Our public health has been threatened. We've been put into fear. We have idled our country and our economy and our communities in so many ways that have impacted us all and really hurt the nation. So public health threats and fear and the idling, it sounds like a Superfund site, right? It sounds like a brownfield. And there is a brownfield, that's actually a CERCLA site in Alabama. So, but just like we know that a phoenix can rise up from a brownfield or a Superfund site, for those of you who know the Phoenix Awards for the best brownfield projects, we know that we have the opportunity to rise up as a nation as well and build back better. We are poised for revitalization right now. Yesterday, the President of the United States signed a $2 trillion piece of legislation that has resources in it that will help us not only revive as a country, revive our economies and communities, but I believe help us revive brownfields as well. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So this is not about Opportunity Zone, these resources for redevelopment, but I think it's very relevant. So first of all, over the last couple of years since the Tax Cut and Jobs Act created the Opportunity Zone program, several federal agencies have prioritized federal grant funding for Opportunity Zone districts, Opportunity Zone census tracts. And we've been able to secure Department of Transportation, U.S. Department of Commerce, and EPA grants in Opportunity Zones because it is a federal investment priority. The U.S. EPA Brownfield Superfund and Land Revitalization Programs are getting congressional spending levels that are really as high as they've ever been. The U.S. House came out in January of 20, but then we all got sidetracked with this COVID-19 crisis, but is now moving again with the Moving Forward Act, which is a $1.5 trillion legislative package. It's an infrastructure bill. This infrastructure bill is going to be put into the context of a larger infrastructure bill that I'll talk about in a moment. But for really the first time ever, this transportation and infrastructure bill coming out of the House identifies brownfields as infrastructure that needs investment, and talks about raising the brownfield grant funding level annually from the around $80 million that it gets a year now to $350 million in the next budget cycle, and goes up and up $50 million every year, to the point that in 2025 there would be, under this law, $550 million a year for brownfield grants, which is, you know, it's six times what we have now. Sorry, I'm whenever a user steps away and a window pops up that says a user steps away, my PowerPoint controls kind of turn off, so bear with me. There's a Phoenix. You all remember that. Okay. So there's funding for opportunity zones. There's brownfields money. Brownfields is in the infrastructure bill. These are a bit unrelated, but in the bill that passed right after Christmas, the year-long appropriations for fiscal year 2021 and the it had a stimulus bill, you know, right after Christmas. Two different acts were in there. The American Compete Act prioritizes investment in advanced manufacturing, artificial intelligence, robotics, additive manufacturing, which is 3D printing. It also had a major Energy Act of 2020. Not a lot of news on that because January's been busy, but there's major incentives for kind of all of the above energy development scheme, including huge amounts of smart city, clean energy, and energy infrastructure in that act. President Biden came in, and within his first week, he put forward a Buy America executive order, and then in February, he put forward America's Supply Chains executive order that is calling for major investment in U.S. manufacturing in very innovative areas and the devotion of lots of resources to that. So what can you do on an old Superfund site? What can you do on an idle brownfield? You can do these kinds of clean energy, advanced manufacturing, and other things that are going to be a big priority coming up. And then what everybody knows about is what passed into law yesterday with signature by the president, $1.9 trillion, and there are billions of dollars for community revitalization. Local government and state government officials, I'm sure, are aware that there'll be $350 billion coming to states, tribes, territories, and local governments, and there are parameters on how those can be used, but there's a clear provision in that law that they can be used for recovering from the economic impacts that were caused by the national emergency of the COVID. In addition to that, there is billions of dollars for transit infrastructure. There is $3 billion for the Economic Development Administration. That's about eight, nine times what it gets in a normal year. There are all kinds of funds that there's funding for water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure. So, you know, you need those kinds of infrastructure. You need those kinds of resources to make a Superfund redevelopment project or a brownfield revitalization work in many times. And that money is on the way and to the rescue. And what we're going to be turning to next is President Biden pledged in his campaign and early on, and anybody working with the administration knows that as soon as this rescue plan was passed, they were going to turn to the Build Back Better recovery plan, which is essentially an infrastructure bill. I talked a little bit about transportation infrastructure, but they will package it together with energy infrastructure, sewer, water, stormwater, broadband, smart cities, brownfields, and clean energy. There's a big plank for manufacturing that's going to be part of this. And so there's going to be resources, if this passes, for the kinds of investment and redevelopment that can make a Superfund site turn into something better. These are the kinds of resources that can prepare Opportunity Zone sites to be shovel ready and investment ready. And I'm going to talk more about that. So lot of resources, more than any that in my lifetime, in my professional career, and I dare say more than any of us, unless there's some people who were in business during the Great Depression on this webcast. So, all right, so major pieces of legislation, just like the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, was a major piece of legislation with bipartisan support to create the Opportunity Zone program. It took a while for U.S. Treasury to create the regulatory structure and regulatory guidance. It was finally December 19th, 2019, when those regulations were final, and everybody said, boy, 2020 is going to be the year when Opportunity Fund investments go into action. Everybody was poised, ready, and excited. Well, then, guess what? In January and then through March a year ago, the COVID took us down. So, but what I will say, and I'm just going to repeat a little bit of what Brad expertly described, the U.S. EPA, Office of Land and Emergency Management, took very proactive steps to ensure that brownfields, vacant land, and other contaminated sites were part of the Opportunity Zone regulations, part of the program, and able to be revitalized with Opportunity Fund money. There were a couple rounds of EPA comments to the U.S. Treasury. I was contracted, my firm was contracted to draft those comments for EPA to Treasury. I'll give the credit to my colleague Ashley Baddish, who was the real brains behind that, but I was involved as well. I worked with people like our next speaker, John Grossans, to put that together, and other experts across the country. And what turned out in the second round of guidance, the final regulations, I can actually say we were thinking that the regulations would not be kind to contaminated sites. They ended up being extremely beneficial for contaminated sites. But what it talked about was brownfields. So other leaders, including people like John on the phone and Bill, our speaker, Kat West of Skio Solutions, which is a part of the host of this webcast, they said, how do we apply these kind of brownfield opportunity zone tools to Superfund redevelopment programs? So some key stakeholders made sure it happened, and now EPA is doing things like this webcast to talk about how there are wonderful opportunities for the application of these OZ and Opportunity Fund investments, not just in kind of your standard brownfield, but in other kinds of sites, including Superfund sites. And that's what we're talking about today. So I'm going to talk about some of the key concepts for opportunity zones and contaminated sites. Brad Carney did an excellent job in this, so I'm just going to touch on a couple key points to reinforce what Brad and others have said. So, first of all, opportunity funds must, under the regulation, invest their assets, a bulk of their assets, in either a qualified opportunity zone business or property, as Brad explained. So as Brad said, most of the attention is on the property aspect of it and less on the businesses, at least that I've seen thus far. But a qualified OZ property must be within an opportunity zone, one of the 8,400 or so census tracts, and must either commence an original use on that property or substantially improve that property by doubling the basis of that property within 30 months. Brad said it well. You can't take a Superfund site, buy it, and turn it around from a regulatory, remedial, and legal process in 30 months, unless it's almost there when you buy it already. It's a very difficult thing to do in that quick of a time. And the same for brownfields and other contaminated sites as well. You're going to go through a voluntary cleanup program and come up with all the horizontal preparation and vertical development in 30 months, you got some magic going for you. So although the substantial improvement test can be useful at CERCLA, Superfund, and brownfield contaminated sites, you really want to be in original use. And what that means is, well, so the IRS regulations that came out in December 2019 made very clear that the site preparation and horizontal development that you need to put the vertical economic development into place, those things, whether they be mundane like grading or they be highly complex like remedial action, assessment, remedial action, cleanup, all of those things which are costly can count as qualified for opportunity fund investment. Now, the IRS made clear that kind of brownfield land flippers who go in and do, you know, cleanup and some horizontal site preparation and then flip, flip the land to others to do the vertical development of buildings or structures or factories or whatever it be, IRS does, regulations do not really support the kind of land flipping activities. But if your site preparation is tied to the vertical development and economic development you're going to do, then those costs can count. And when those costs, I mean, it's been a while since I've looked at the average cost of a Superfund cleanup, but I remember when it was about $60 million, you want to be able to use qualified opportunity funds and get the tax benefits when you're spending that kind of money before you build the shopping center or the commercial center or whatever it be. Another benefit is that sites that meet the CERCLA definition of brownfields meet the original use test and are not bound by all of the strict timelines that come for doubling the basis under the substantially improved test. Brad explained this in detail, but so a straight up brownfield, we know that RCRA sites can, with EPA regional waiver, be treated as if it's a brownfield under the longstanding brownfield law and the more recent Build Act of 2017. We know that some of those, the bulk of CERCLA sites are not NPL sites, they're EPA removal sites. You know, these tools can be used at those non-NPL sites to meet the original use test as a brownfield and get those benefits. And again, that doesn't mean an NPL site cannot use opportunity zones. You're just going to have to work around different ways to be able to get the opportunity fund investment to qualify. And one of those ways, as Mr. Carney explained well, is that vacant land, that is at least 80% of the land or building, is significantly unused at the time of the designation of the opportunity zone and for at least a year before the purchase of the site, or as Brad explained, for a period of 3 years before the purchase of the site. In other cases, that can meet the original use test and avoid the difficulties of the substantially improved test. So a vacant site, whether it be NPL or RCRA or Superfund, could meet the OZ test here. So this is very significant that there are different time tests. It's not the 30-month test for substantially improving your property, but there are different time tests for when you have to really put your qualified opportunity fund capital to work. They're not really looking for people to buy a piece of land and bank it for, you know, a decade and then finally start spending money on it. They really want to get capital invested, and so the regulations from Treasury and the law has a 31-month test to deploy your money. But what about if you can't get through your state voluntary cleanup program quite as fast as you thought because of an unexpected issue? It could be an issue involved with the state not having the capacity to process your voluntary cleanup program application as quickly as you had expected. There's 100 different permitting and regulatory delays that may keep you from meeting that, put your qualified opportunity fund capital into place. Treasury came out and said, if there are permitting delays, and they described them, your time is tolled until those permitting delays are taken care of, which is a huge benefit for brownfields property. And then I think I have one more bullet here. All right. A redeveloper that purchases a site from a local government, and that local government acquired the site by what used to be called the involuntary acquisition test, and I'll talk more about this, can also meet the original use test when they acquire from that local government and become the new owner and want to do opportunity zone investments. So brownfield and cleanup costs, they count. The original use test can often be claimed to be able to move through your opportunity fund investment. There's lots of good stuff in the Treasury regulations that could help you at your Superfund or brownfield site. So one of those issues I was asked to talk about, so I'll just talk a little bit about local government and voluntary acquisition. I've worked with folks for, gosh, probably 20 years on that involuntary acquisition issue. It's basically a protection for local governments, a defense against Superfund liability. If the local government acquired the site in its function as a sovereign involuntarily, it was always called. So there you go. There's a gold sovereign coin with the queen on it. That involuntary acquisition protection from CERCLA liability changed in the Build Brownfield Act of 2017. And Treasury has recognized that local governments use this tool to acquire sites or to take sites that are essentially abandoned. And so how can you involuntarily or acquire as a sovereign, as a local government? This bullet is that the IRS Opportunity Fund regulations say, as Brad said and as I already said, that if a developer or investor buys a site from the local government and the local government obtained it through this involuntary transfer, then you meet the original use test if you meet all other parts of it. So what is an involuntary acquisition? Just quickly, it can include foreclosure, a tax foreclosure, a demolition foreclosure, a demolition lien foreclosure, transfers between the local government that acquired it and the Economic Development Authority or the land bank or other local unit. That second unit, the land bank or the Economic Development Authority, is considered to have an intergovernmental transfer from the first unit of local government, and they involuntarily acquired it. They acquired it as a sovereign. Tax increment finance transactions, eminent domain. It's a complicated area. As we know, eminent domain was limited by many states and federal agencies after the Kelo case in the Supreme Court, I don't know, what was that, 20 years ago? So eminent domain for public use, escheat, conservatorship, these are the ways local governments acquire sites. So if you buy a site from a local government that acquired it in one of these ways, you've got the benefit of the original use test. And that sovereign acquisition process was clarified by EPA's Office of Site Remediation Enforcement a couple of years ago in the wake of statutory improvements to that legal test in the Brownfield Build Act of 2017. This Clue-In webcast has a link to that guidance, very useful to read. So that's one aspect of involuntary acquisition. Okay. I'm done talking about opportunity zones from a regulatory and legal perspective, and I'm going to talk in four slides here about making opportunity zones work for your local community's redevelopment. This is a practical perspective on what you really do with all this mumbo-jumbo of law. So it was said that the secret to success is to be ready when your opportunity comes, sticking with the opportunity zone theme. And so the first thing you really need to do to transform a Superfund or brownfield site is create a community vision for what that site can become again. And so some interesting things you should be thinking about: investments in solar generation facilities, bright fields, wind fields, other renewable energy investment on a Superfund site, which is something that EPA has been promoting for a long time, could be investable for opportunity funds under everything we're talking about today. I would commend to you the Repowering America Land website and the whole bevy of tools that EPA, together with the Department of Energy, have put together for doing wind, solar, and other renewable energy on brownfields. Excellent use for that. Another area that I touched on earlier in this webcast is manufacturing. You got a big Superfund site with significant contamination issues. Maybe you're not going to remediate it to meet residential standards. Maybe it's not appropriate for residential. Some are, some aren't. New manufacturing on old brownfields. That's why I talked about these Biden executive orders and the laws passed at the end of 2020. There's going to be a massive investment in manufacturing. So I would commend to you the EPA guide called New Manufacturing on Old Brownfields. It's available in this webcast. It's available on the EPA website, and it talks about how to bring new innovative manufacturing back to the ruins of the old manufacturing. I was pleased to work for the EPA Brownfields office to draft that guide and work with lots of communities that are doing that kind of work. And then a lot of opportunity funds are going into more traditional real estate development, you know, commercial buildings, mixed-use buildings, shopping centers, and things like that. There's a lot of people who are more expert than me on real estate development, but I would urge you to do what a lot of communities must do and are doing. What kind of development are we going to have in the post-COVID era? What kind of economic development are we going to have in the era when we need to be really paying attention to equity and race and inclusion in so many ways after this last year or so? And you know, are we going to build things the same way as they were before when we used to congregate freely? Or are we going to have different modes of work and different modes of commuting and different modes of development and smarter ways to develop? And, you know, accessibility, whether it be transit or broadband or other ways for all, when we're doing this economic development, that's what cities are thinking about right now. And that's a great way for you to put opportunity fund investments into your Superfund or brownfield site. There's a lot of ways you can look at that. I would commend to you Smart Growth America. There's a URL there. They talk a lot about smart growth, urban development, smart rural development, equitable development. And Smart Growth America runs an organization that I see on this attendance list that my good friend Ken Brown is on this webcast. Ken Brown and I founded the National Brownfields Coalition a couple decades ago. It's being run by Smart Growth America now. And so these kinds of ideas about smart, fair, sustainable development on our brownfields, that's a good place to go. Okay. So second slide on making opportunity zones work. You've got to get shovel ready and investment ready for opportunity funds. Thomas Edison once said that opportunity is missed by most people because it is dressed in overalls and it looks like work. That means, you know, opportunity fund money is not going to fall out of the sky onto your Superfund site and magically, you know, create redevelopment. Your community has to get shovel ready for this and investment ready. And what I mean is that in my work with communities, the most difficult thing is that there's a point in the deal flow pipeline that an opportunity fund investor is going to come in. They're not going to come in when you don't have any remedial plan, you don't have any entitlements for development, you don't have any zoning set, and you don't know what you're going to build, right? You're never going to get an opportunity fund investor to come in. They tend to be more last dollar investors than first dollar investors. So all of the due diligence that you have to do to create the vision, create the productive reuse plan, get everything ready, for that, line up infrastructure, line up local support and stakeholder support, line up all your remedial plans that you have to do on a contaminated site, line up other pieces of financing. That's what you need to do to get a project investment ready for an opportunity fund manager. So EPA's been dealing with those kinds of ideas for a long time, as of many of you, many states. I would recommend to you a guide that I helped put together for EPA called Community Actions That Drive Brownfields Redevelopment. It's how do you create market pull? How do you help make a site ready for reuse? How do you attract developers by getting rid of the barriers, building the local vision, engaging developers, and closing the deal with private sector redevelopers who may be using opportunity funds? This resource is linked to this webcast and available at EPA. Likewise, I would recommend to you another publication I put together with the late, great Charlie Parch, who, you know, invented the word brownfields and was the father of the industry, a good man, leveraging resources for brownfields revitalization, how you stack up capital, how you bring in different sources of revenue to be able to make a brownfield or contaminated site project work. And one of those sources, this guide was not written when there were opportunity funds, but certainly leveraging opportunity funds with other pieces of resources is how you make opportunity zones work. Okay, I think I'm about out of time. There's a lot of talk out there about creating a pitch book and or a pitch website about your project. What are the competitive advantages of your community? What are the site advantages you have? What is your vision and redevelopment program? What is your pro forma? What capital are you stacking up already? Who's behind you, not just investors and financiers, but mayors and county commissioners and state senators? And then your pitch book should have a clear pitch on, we have this much of a gap, it's appropriate for opportunity fund investment equity, and it'll bring a rate of return. We put into this webcast a guidebook from the Brookings Institution that talks about how to put together a pitch book. I put together a bunch for a bunch of different communities, including for contaminated sites. You got to get lined up and put together a pitch book. And then finally, I think this is my last slide. Where do you find the money? We all know, show me the money. And I just say a couple points, right? Novogradic is an accounting firm that has done some of the top work in the nation on new market tax credits, all kinds of other tax credits. And they're also a top leader in opportunity zones. And they have a list at this website with dozens and dozens and dozens of opportunity fund investors, what regions they're investing in, what kind of projects they're investing in, websites, contact information, investment criteria. That's a great place for you to go to find an opportunity zone that matches your region or your project. And then I'll also just say, this is a big subject, but you can go to a big bank that's created an opportunity zone or a big fund that is investing in different opportunity zones. You can also create a single asset opportunity fund that will allow you to put money that is subject to capital gains tax through your opportunity fund that's like Kansas Superfund Site Redevelopment Fund, Inc., to be able to get those tax advantages. You can talk with Brad Carney or another good tax lawyer to figure out how to do those things. So that's a wrap. And I want to thank everybody for being here. And I will just end this Opportunity Zone webcast by quoting the great Milton Berle, who said, if opportunity doesn't knock, build a door. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate that. That was really, really a great presentation, and I just really enjoyed listening to that. It's so great for us, that work on the regulatory side of things to hear people talk about how projects are successfully put together. And so appreciate your expertise and being on the webinar. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to John Grosshans from Region 5, who's the Opportunity Zone Coordinator in the Midwest region to give us a little overview, more of an overview of opportunity zones and EPA programs. John?
Thanks, Bill. This is John Grossant, and I'm located in Chicago. I work out of the EPA Great Lakes office here in Region 5. And most of my time is spent blending environmental and economic outcomes in the stressed communities. And I'll focus on the how. So how do you take some of this information we've heard so far and turn it into a next step on your site, in your community, in your learning about opportunity zones? And I will just say that this lineup here has been really effective. I think, Bill, the intro on Superfund redevelopment and then the opportunity zone introduction followed by Brad's baseline of what is the opportunity zone program actually do, what is the tax incentive about, and Matt has advanced that to look at how does that apply to contaminated lands, and I just love the nuggets that were pulled out recently about Superfund eligibility, brownfield eligibility, which costs are eligible, the key words like vertical development and how do you get your project qualified. A lot of one-liners in there that had a lot of value that are really helpful, I think, in just understanding how this all works as environmental application. So I'm going to talk a little bit about EPA's connections and really focus on the resources that are available to help people get to that next step. The overall goal of this IRS tax credit is to get investors with capital gains to put money into brick-and-mortar development on Main Street. Brad explained that in the first session. Well, I work on a lot of Main Streets in the Midwest, and I can tell you that as soon as you start talking about putting a shovel in the ground, you are talking about a lot of environmental programs and applications. And so the focus of this program being on commercial industrial development, doing kind of vacant to some sort of construction program, all of a sudden raises all sorts of questions and opportunities around environmental programs. So EPA's connections to opportunity zones are many. We're focusing on the land side in this particular webinar, but we could just as easily have been talking about other programs, underground infrastructure. We could be talking about energy efficiency and how some of these other EPA applications have relevance to opportunity zones. But I think that it is smart to talk about the land cleanup first because it really is the strongest connection. We've got a lot of different land cleanup programs at EPA. We've talked about them already, but they are really so connected to this program because of the site-specific nature of the work. So what I'm going to talk about here is the connections that EPA has to tools, and I'm going to go through really a kind of an overview of a whole bunch of tools that we could spend a lot of time on individually. In the related URL section of your screen on the right, I think it's on the right-hand side, there is a whole list of websites, links. A lot of what I'm about to talk about, a lot of what we covered already, is in those related URLs, so you're going to have access to this information. Absolutely, click on them, read them, download them, save them, use them. That's why we're putting all these URLs there. They're a little bit lengthy, but these are all kind of tucked away in there. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some resources that came from Brownfields Superfund, as well as the Office of Community Revitalization, and really hit a whole smattering of areas that might be useful to you in your next steps. Okay, so where to start? The first place to start is the EPA Opportunity Zone portal. We're all about portals nowadays, so you can kind of go to one place and find your way from there, and that, if nothing else, is a great place to start when you're looking for resources. And that is going to have information on some of the things we've already talked about, fact sheets related to brownfields, fact sheets related to Superfund. Of course, there is already a brownfield or a Superfund redevelopment webpage with fact sheets that go into some of the details that were mentioned earlier. Things like the Brownfields Federal Programs Guide has a couple of pages now dedicated to opportunity zones that will copy out the language from the actual tax credit information that talks about the applicability of that vacant land or some of those original use issues that Brad raised earlier. So if you have a need for finding more information related to the contamination-specific sections, it's going to be in those places. But I think a lot of people really want to just, maybe before they dive into the the very nitty-gritty tax implications, just understand, am I part of the zone or am I not part of the zone? Where is my project site? And we've got a couple of resources that can help with that. We've got Cleanups in My Community, which is an EPA website that has all sorts of cleanup activity, whether it's Superfund, brownfields, et cetera, nationally listed, so it shows where investments have been made, where projects are located. An opportunity zone layer has been added to that map, and so you can actually see on the map really quickly, am I in, am I out? One of the pros and cons of this program is if you're in, you're in. If you're out, you are out. And so it is really helpful to know where you stand from a geography perspective. And so Cleanups in My Community is one way to do that. EPA just released a opportunity zone mapper, and this is a pilot that's out right now, and it really looks at what are the zones, what are some of the other resources that might be in play around those zones. So it's a way to start thinking about revitalization from a spatial perspective. I think that these links are in the URLs, and certainly you can get at them from some of these other sites. But those are two great starting places for when we're starting to think about what do you do kind of first, second, and third. How can EPA help? What are some of the tools we have out there? Well, one of the questions that always comes up is, what is the site going to become? Oftentimes, the sites we're talking about, Superfund or other, they don't look like a pretty site that's ready for development. They kind of look like a hot mess. They've got vacant property. They've got potential dilapidated buildings. It's just not a very scenic project that you can point to and say, yes, we should invest millions of dollars into this site. But oftentimes they do have value, and they've got strategic locations. They've got something that is going for them from a redevelopment perspective. And so if you can just enhance that through redevelopment planning, wouldn't it be a site sketch? It could be just understanding contamination, where it's at, and what can be done to develop with that in mind. These are all really helpful first steps for getting investor attention. Matt mentioned earlier being shovel-ready, and this is absolutely part of that shovel-ready process, is making sure that you're ready to go and you can show people what it can become, not just what it is today. Another thing that is really helpful is matchmaking. So Matt, again, talked about this earlier, funds, investors, how do you connect to them? Well, there's a couple different ways that can happen. It can literally happen in a room or in a conference where you're actually hosting investors to look at sites. Here's an example from Lorain, Ohio. We did some technical assistance with them where we talked about how do they connect their waterfront, which has been largely cleaned up, to investors that might want to take a second look at what's possible on some of those project sites. Each of those project sites, in turn, were in a different state of readiness. How do we kind of assess and hold up each project individually and say, okay, this one's here, this other one's there. If you're looking for this type of project or this type of acreage, these are the projects that might make a lot of sense. So this matchmaking is really important as well. Communities, of course, can do this on their own. Matt spoke to this a second ago with how you can raise projects up to their attention. And this is a way to do that. We've got a couple of kind of shorter tools. And this might be something you want to review and take a look at or circulate in your own community. Just looking at that readiness. How are you being shovel ready in your site work? How do you know when you're there? When you've got a lot of these kind of questions checked. So that's something else that we have available and is in that related URL list. A lot of the discussion we focused on has been really centered on opportunity zones. Are you in or are you not? And for a lot of sites, you're not. You're not in there. But that doesn't mean that you can't start using these tools to get to the same end result, and that is external investor attention. Yes, today is about opportunity funds and opportunity zones, but we know that's not the only investor in town. We know there's a lot of other redevelopers that are out there. And so many of these tools will actually be useful for those that are outside of the zones or just doing good Superfund redevelopment work. So one tool that might be helpful to anyone is really looking at this idea of the site readiness, the community prospectus development tool. Cities are often saying, you know, how do we hold up our sites? We know what we have. How do we convey that to others outside of our community? And there's a lot of different ways that communities are doing this. So we put together a way to kind of map out how do you make that process happen and therefore take some of the mystery out of that prospectus development. And a prospectus is really just a way to hold up a series of properties or areas for investment as a strategy so investors can see that there is some level of readiness. And you're also, at the same time, you're conveying the community values. If you hold up projects in a specific way, you're able to also articulate what are those local goals? What are the benefits you're hoping to get out of this investment? I think it's a really good way to start a two-way conversation with the investment community, with the community laying out what it would like to achieve with this particular projects. As part of that tool, and as many of these tools, we talk about, you know, where does this fit within the overall revitalization process? And again, this is not unique to opportunity zones or opportunity fund investments. It's something that really is relevant to any sort of redevelopment process. How do you go from that vision and that initial foray into feasibility to get through the funding and the actual implementation? It looks the same, whether you have opportunity fund money in there or you have other types of money in that project. And so it's just really helpful to have some of these tools that can explain what you'd like to do for second and third, how you can kind of start down this path, regardless of the opportunity fund money. I was in a conversation recently with actually a person who was raising capital for a project, and she explained that in many cases, you don't know if you have an opportunity fund investor at the beginning. You just start doing good redevelopment planning. And then down the road, you find out, hey, this is something you can weave into the process to fill a gap in your capital stack. I think that's pretty common. I think that a lot of times you're just working on a project, trying to get the work to happen, and it becomes apparent somewhere in between the start and the end that there's an opportunity zone connection. This webinar is really good just to make sure that everyone's aware of how it applies to contamination, how it applies to sites within EPA's world, so that we're kind of looking for them and thinking of, you know, how we can weave in that opportunity fund angle. But certainly, it's really about good redevelopment planning and process. So similarly, one of the other things that's come out recently is a series of development finance tools. So for those that don't speak finance all the time, this might be helpful for understanding how does an opportunity fund fit within the overall support for a project as an investment tool? How does that tool relate to other types of financing? How do you actually start weaving these together for a project? And so these development finance tools, again, you know, available in the links in the related URL section, are short toolkits that explain, here's what you can do to start thinking about development finance for your project. As Matt said, you know, these are questions that are going to come up at the end of your project, not the very beginning. For opportunity zones, there are time constraints, but really for any type of investment, there's a time constraint. So it always is helpful to understand as you reach that kind of end stage of the project what that financing picture might look like. And so these two separate tools are available online to help distinguish what your financing options might look like and how to move those forward. And then I will just end with a general statement on EPA and its other federal partners. So EPA has a whole series of toolkits. We've got things that you can access for mapping, for finance, for actual contamination work, for redevelopment assistance. That's all part of our collective toolkit. But we are just one federal agency within a broader federal family. For instance, HUD has their own set of opportunity zone toolkits. And so I just wanted to highlight these as well, because again, for those that are not in an opportunity zone or those that are part of a community that has broader issues than just a single site, and you want to think broadly about how you can do redevelopment or revitalization along an entire waterfront or an entire part of town, these toolkits are great resources to understand what are other communities doing? How are they achieving their visioning or their holding up of projects to investors or taking steps for readiness or infrastructure investment? And so I think that these tools are also not to be overlooked, even though they're not EPA per se, but they're HUD. And they've also got their own series of webinars, just like this one. So if you want to really dive into the details on some other opportunity zone information, feel free to go to this HUD website, which has a whole bunch of information. And most recently, they did a three-part series on their toolkits as well, which is really helpful in understanding, again, what's the breadth of activity that can be done to prepare sites for investments and the overall community for some form of revitalization. And with that, I will hand the mic back to Bill But not without saying that Bill's done a great job of leading both the Superfund redevelopment work as well as teeing up this opportunity discussion. So thank you, Bill, for really being the driver for many of these discussions.
Well, thanks, John. I really appreciate that, and thank you for your expertise. I want to just take a minute to thank all of our speakers for their presentations. I always learn something when I listen to a presentation on Opportunity Zones, and certainly did today. So it was great to hear more about Opportunity Zones as they relate to redeveloping Superfund sites. So I'm going to go pretty quickly just through a couple of closing things to leave us some time for a question and answer. So I just wanted to point out a couple of things. We have a lot of tools available for helping facilitate redevelopment of Superfund sites, whether or not they're in Opportunity Zones, and we've been doing this for a long time. We can have conversations. We can issue comfort letters or ready for reuse determinations. We've developed guidance and policies, doing things like this training webinar and others on redeveloping Superfund sites. And there's just a lot of support within the regions and within headquarters for getting Superfund sites back into productive use. I wanted to put up this slide, and it'll be available in the slides for the presentation. If you are interested in redeveloping a Superfund site, the very first step and really the main thing you need to know is to contact one of these people. These are the regional Superfund redevelopment coordinators. A lot of them are remedial project managers as well. And so, you know, have a real breadth of expertise in dealing with cleanup issues and with redevelopment issues, and certainly will know how to best direct resources that EPA may have to support the redevelopment. We also wanted to point out that we have a couple of upcoming training opportunities. On April 20th. We have an equitable redevelopment and environmental justice webinar. We're coining this term, I believe, equitable redevelopment. We hear about equitable development a lot, and certainly there's a lot in that. But we're specifically looking at equitable redevelopment and the role that EPA can play in helping ensure that redevelopment projects are sustainable and equitable for everyone. So also on Friday, May 7th, we're hosting a webinar on renewable energy on Superfund sites and optimizing reuse. So hopefully you can tune in for those. For more information, you can contact me. I'm Bill Denman. Like I said, I'm in EPA Region 4, have worked with headquarters on Superfund redevelopment for a long time, and I'm happy to either answer your questions or help get you to the right person, or you can send an email to Frank Avasado in our headquarters, who has been doing this with Kat and I and Skio and John and all of the folks at EPA for a really long time, and can also help you with getting you to the right person to help with your project. So either Frank or I or anyone on this presentation would be glad to talk with you. And like I said before, check out our redevelopment program website. There's just tons of information on there, and certainly we're very proud of a lot of the projects that we're doing. I also wanted to point out that we're in the process of putting up a map of Superfund sites that are in Opportunity Zones. The map with a layer of Superfund sites in Opportunity Zone is on our website now, and I believe Josie is adding a resource to the webinar to that map. So you can take a look and take a look at Superfund sites that are located in Opportunity Zones. So with that, let's move on to the questions. And let's see. I'm going to go through a few questions for me first, and then I'll direct some to the other moderators. So someone asked what the site was that I mentioned in Georgia that was a wood treating facility and is now a soccer field. That is the Camilla wood treating site in Georgia. It's in Camilla, Georgia. So you can take a look at that. I believe we have some information on our redevelopment website as well that will highlight that. How early on in the Superfund cleanup process can a property be appropriated for a designated future use? At any point, either before or during the Superfund cleanup process, sites can be, in fact, the earlier the better, as I mentioned. We're actually required by guidance to evaluate the term as reasonably anticipated future land use, and that helps guide our remedial investigation and feasibility study, if you're familiar with the Superfund process. Basically, if we look at a piece of property and the reasonably anticipated future land use is commercial, industrial, or residential, or ecological, then we can start looking at the risk associated with that type of use and getting any restrictions in place that need to be put in place to ensure that kind of use. And so the bottom line is the earlier the better in working with EPA on these. Okay, Brad, here's a question for you. So here's the question. I'm working on a Superfund site that is not located in an opportunity zone, but abuts an opportunity zone. It's separated by a 200-foot river. Can an existing opportunity zone's physical limits be amended to, in my case, to include the Superfund site? I think I know the answer to that, but let's see.
That's a great question. If the Superfund site itself is 100% outside the opportunity zone, no, you're not going to qualify within the opportunity zone. There's not really an opportunity to amend it. However, there are in the final regulations that came out after the second public hearing, there are regulations that describe what if your property straddles an opportunity zone where you do have a certain percentage in an opportunity zone, and there is a formula that's based on area that would qualify it. But if you're 100% out, I would say no, that won't qualify for purposes of the tax benefit.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And that's what I thought the answer was. So that's always good when I think I knew what it was, and it turns out to be right. Yeah, as we said, the state governors designated opportunity zones, and I believe it was John said, the most important thing is to determine are you in or are you out? So do you qualify under one of the designations that we talked about, or are you physically located in? And unfortunately, there's no ability to amend that for now. I mean, I guess, this could continue. There could be expanded opportunity zones, and so it'd certainly, keep abreast of things going on in that area. Okay, next question. So, Brad, this is also for you. I understand that the maximum tax benefit from opportunity zones is achieved by investing soon after the program was initiated. Given the additional time needed for cleanup, is there a way to extend the benefit to overcome this comparative disadvantage?
That's another terrific question. So the tax benefit that is not being realized today is the 15% step up in basis of the capital gain tax that will be paid on April 15th of 2027, because the Qualified Opportunity Fund had to hold the Qualified Opportunity Zone business property for at least 7 years to get that additional 5% step up. And the reason why I think it's such a great question is because I had a similar concern when I was speaking at the Department of Treasury public hearing. I had mentioned the fact that at that time the proposed regulation, which became final as to the third tax benefit, which is the zero federal capital gains tax on the capital gain on the appreciation of the property, gets to be realized all the way to 2047, well past the time when all the zones become de-designated in 2028. Why not hold the same thing with the step-up in basis? And I was reminded repeatedly during those public hearings that the Department of Treasury cannot go beyond the statutory framework, that the regulations that they develop have to fit within the statutory framework. And the way the statute is set up, unless it's amended by Congress, it would not permit an amendment for that that additional step up in basis. But although you may be losing the step up in basis, the Qualified Opportunity Fund, I think the big one is holding it for 10 years or more to get that zero federal capital gains tax on when they eventually sell the property and it's appreciated. And by the way, I know I'm probably droning on here, but the reason why it's going out to 2047 is so that the fund isn't forced to sell at a fire sale in the event that the real estate market is in a downturn.
Well, that's really interesting. That's very helpful perspective to have there. And so I think I learned about five things in your answer right there. So like I said, I'm always learning new things about opportunity zones. So thank you for that. And I appreciate your expertise on that answer. Okay, so I think we have one more for you. Are you aware of any properties in New Jersey that are in the queue that are vacant and waiting for the 3 years to run that will then move into redevelopment?
I am not aware of specific go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, we get this question at EPA a lot, you know, especially by people who go through the process of purchasing a Superfund site and redeveloping it, and they learn how the process works and the benefits and, you know, how they can do this. And so, yeah, we get questions a lot, too, that, well, hey, do you know of any sites, you know, where, you know, we can go through this again? And that's kind of what this question seems to be getting to, other than just the waiting for the 3 years. So, yeah, so if you would go ahead.
Sure, right. So just talking generally, not necessarily a Superfund site, the state of New Jersey does have an excellent mapping tool where you can they have a marketplace, but they also have a mapping tool where you can click on opportunity zones in the state of New Jersey, and you can sort of zoom in and see the process there. I will say that I don't want to be too specific, but our firm, for example, we serve as redevelopment council for seven municipalities in New Jersey that also overlay with opportunity zones, and there are often in the downtown of some of these towns business properties that have been vacant for three or more years. Some are very proactive, as Matt was suggesting. Local government can't just sit on its hands. It needs to get out there with a marketing approach, a prospectus, if you will, to advertise their vacant properties and why it would be beneficial for a fund to come in to that community. So I can't on this call name specific properties have been vacant for 3 years or more, but you could go to the New Jersey state page, and it has a nice mapping tool for that purpose.
Great. All right. Well, thank you. That's a great suggestion. And yeah, I know that a lot of municipality states, even like I just said with EPA, you know, we're looking at mapping applications to help advertise, you know, where these areas are and properties that may be in that. So, Matt, we have some questions for you now. This is, let's see, it's relative to a designation change. So I'm an RPM at a lead site in southwest Missouri. An opportunity zone boundary comes right up to the city limits of the town that I'm overseeing active lead remediation. Will there ever be a possibility in the future for the small town I work in to apply for an opportunity zone designation? Okay, so I think I'm going to answer this one, Matt, and then you can expand on it afterwards to see if I have this right. So, yes, opportunity zones were designated at a single point in time. They are what they are now. Certainly, they could be amended. So am I kind of on point there?
Well, that is the biggest question. Can you hear me, Bill?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yep. Okay, that is the biggest question I've gotten. Some states had very kind of orderly and open processes by which localities and other stakeholders could ask for a census tract to be a qualified census tract to be able to be deemed an opportunity zone by a governor and affirmed by Treasury. And some states were not as open and engaged with stakeholders. They were kind of picked in the back room of the governor's office. And so there's a lot of communities that say, well, what about our census tracts? The question was, could my small town ever be an opportunity zone? Well, the answer is yes, but I think it's going to take, I would welcome Brad Carney's view on this. I think it's going to take a statutory amendment to be able to do that. There's really a very set process in the 2017 Act for how these are set. I don't think a governor can just move a boundary or choose a different census tract. And so I've told people you got to wait for tax legislation, and you better wait until after the presidential election. And there has been a presidential election, and I predict we're going to see very new tax legislation proposed. You know, where that goes is, you know, I work in Washington, but I sit in West Virginia. I live in West Virginia. So I would say ask Joe Manchin where that's going to go. Brad, I don't think you can do it without new tax legislation. Do you?
I completely agree with that. That answer is spot on. One other point with that, too, is that the census tracts are based on the 2010 census. So, you know, we're going to have much more updated census information in 2020 because a lot changes, obviously, in 10 years. Any amendment to this would require an act of Congress to amend the statute.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you all very much. That's a really great answer. We're so happy to have people with your level of expertise on the phone. So it's really wonderful to understand, you know, the complexity of this. So next question. So does the Superfund lien process complicate qualified opportunity zone investment? And so I don't know, Matt, are you familiar enough with our lien authorities?
I think I'm going to pass on that, and I bet you're familiar, Bill.
Well, so we have two lien authorities. One is under Superfund, and one is what we call a 107L lien. That's from the CERCLA statute, and that is for recovering past costs at a Superfund site. And then as part of the 2002 amendments, we were also given a lien authority that could – and that's against liable parties. Then we have a lien authority against bona fide prospective purchasers under the windfall lien. So I would say I would think that this is completely separate. You know, the opportunity zone investment and tax benefit is all related to Treasury tax law, and Superfund liens are all related to Superfund liens. So I would say that those would be completely separate.
Yeah, Bill, this is Matt. I would agree with that. I would just say, if you're trying to woo an opportunity fund manager to put, you know, significant funding into your site, and they say, do you have your local zoning to be able to do this this development that you propose to do? And you say, no, and I'll probably never get it. The mayor hates me. That opportunity fund investor is going to walk away. And if the right. opportunity fund investor says, I understand you have you know, significant difficulties dealing with the Superfund liens that are on here and they're unresolved. Yeah, and the EPA regional office won't work with me, which would never happen, I know, but sometimes a lien's a lien. That opportunity fund investor will walk away from you. You've got to get your ducks lined up in a row to be, as I put it, shovel-ready and investment-ready.
Exactly, and I think, you know, just in thinking a little bit more about this question, I think, you know, the issue of windfall liens is one that's extremely complicated, and, you know, we could have a whole webinar just on windfall liens. But certainly that might be something that would need to be thought through and explained because, you know, the windfall lien looks at a windfall as a result of an EPA-funded cleanup, you know, an individual not realizing a windfall from that. But it has to do with current property value, not the appreciation of property value in the future. So that's something that's, you know, scares people off a lot of times because they don't always understand that. They think that, you know, it applies to future appreciation as well. And you know, it's about the fair market value at the time of purchase. So anyway, that's a much more complicated question. So in the interest of time to get to the other questions, we'll move on. Brad, I think this might be for you. Just to confirm, a vacant can mean abandoned building or as for a site this person's working on where the buildings have been torn down for a decade with only the foundations remaining and no current or non-remedial activities on the site.
Yeah, I think that is correct because that would certainly meet the 80% vacancy requirement by square footage, which applies to both building and land. So long as that had remained the case for, let's just say that had been remaining, that occurred after the qualified opportunity zones were designated in 2018 for at least a period of 3 years and up to the time that the Qualified Opportunity Fund purchases the property. Yeah, it applies to that, as well as the one-year requirement if it was vacant at the time, basically, of the designation in 2018, which is a one-year. That's the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Okay. Great. Well, thank you for that. So, Brad or Matt, this could be for either of you. So, are there any provisions in the regulation that would prevent or reduce qualification for state-level brownfield tax credits, assuming a property would qualify for both programs? So this would, I guess they're talking about advantages that the brownfield program offers versus, or how does that work with advantages that the Opportunity Zone regulation?
I bet Brad and I agree, no. I don't think that anything in the Opportunity Zone regulations and how you can take advantage of it would conflict with or double count or otherwise bar utilization of a state brownfield tax incentive. The whole concept is you're going to have to stack up different pieces of capital from different sources, and I don't think that there'd be any prohibition in using OZ if you're also taking some kind of, you know, cleanup depreciation tax at the state or something like that. Brad, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. There's nothing in the regulation or the statute that would, as far as I know, that would prohibit that, right?
Right, and I would agree with that too. I mean, it's like you said, that's kind of the intent of this is to attract private investment to these types of areas, and so because we had them specifically include brownfield sites, that you wouldn't think that there would be a provision that would then, make them not as attractive. So I think we have three agreements on that one for whatever mine's worth. All right. So John, a couple questions for you came in. Which region, and I don't know if you know this, but do you know which region has the most opportunity zones, and are there any in Region 6?
Yes, so questions on location of opportunity zones is a quick Google away. So Brad showed the New Jersey map. So every state will have its own opportunity zone website. They'll have their own mapper. That's a good way to find out at the state level, where are the zones. And then certainly the national resources I mentioned for EPA, the opportunity zone mapper, as well as cleanups in my community, are also great places to start to see what's in your backyard. So if you're looking at a specific site, the whole state, a region, that's going to give you the answers. So yes, Region 6 covered in zones, as are every state. So they're all over the place. And so it's really a matter of zeroing in and kind of zooming in to look at the map to see what is actually covered on the ground.
Thank you, John. Appreciate that. So how many contracts or agreements are typically required for redevelopment? A single agreement, or are there typically many agreements and contracts required on these types of projects? So this is kind of for everyone.
So I'm not sure who... redeveloping a Superfund site with opportunity funds into something big, I don't know, 1,000 contracts? I mean, you're going to have a lot of work to do that. You're going to keep Brad Carney busy for a long time.
I was just going to say that for our own redevelopment projects that don't involve Superfund sites or opportunity zones, we usually have several agreements. And, yes, so with this added layer, there'd be many agreements. It wouldn't be one big super all-purpose agreement.
That sounds great. Okay. All right. Well, that is and I guess I would point out that, with EPA under Superfund, there really would only be, potentially one agreement. There would be any, settling of liens or anything like that, or if there was a bona fide prospective purchaser that wanted to do work or whatever, that's with EPA. But that's more for resolving any type cleanup or lien issues and not for the contract of actually doing the development. So sounds like there's a whole industry out there that can help you with that. So I would like to, I believe that's it for our questions. And we're about, or at least we have time for. So I'm going to go ahead and start the wrap-up process. Again, I want to thank everyone for participating in the in this webinar, and certainly, again, thank our speakers for lending your expertise to us on a Friday afternoon so that we can learn more about this. I would also make a plug for some webinars we've done in the past. We did several webinars on the same webinar several times to talk about the role that local government can play in redevelopment projects. So if you're from a local government and did not get the word about those, please go back and take a look at those archived ones. We even did it in translated in Spanish. So if you would prefer to listen to it in Spanish and that would make more sense to you, please log in and take a look at that. Again, that's all at the cluin.org site. And in addition to that, we have a lot of different topics that we've covered in the past. So I would encourage you to go back and take a look at what's archived under CLUIN. It's and Gene can give us the link to that, but it's clu-in.org. It's a great website with a lot of resources and information on it. So again, thank you all for participating, and thank you to the speakers. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Gene for some final wrap up.
All right. Thank you so very much, Bill. I appreciate it. So just as you were highlighting, we do have the link to the CLUIN website here. So you guys are welcome to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network to learn more about what we have to offer. I will also point out that a number of people have asked for copies of the presentation materials. We have those available posted for you to download. All of the resources and web links as well that were highlighted will be on that page again later today. So you'll have one place where you can download the slides as well as all of the links that were discussed and highlighted in the various presentations today. We also have information for our speakers, including contact information if you want to follow up with anyone on that seminar homepage. So it's the same page that you used when you registered and checked in for today's class. You'll see tabs along that page to jump to information about our presenters, their slides, and their related links. And I will ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's live delivery, including the content as well as the tool that we've used to host it. Now, I am often asked for participation certificates and CLUs and PDHs. I do not issue formal training hours, so there are no CEUs or PDHs, but we can provide you with a participation certificate based on joining today's session. So if you fill out that feedback form and check the box at the bottom of the form, certifying you were here for the whole thing, as soon as you fill in the feedback form, you will immediately have access to a participation certificate with information about the session that you can save for your own records. And oftentimes, our attendees will use those certificates along with the copies of the slides and their registration emails and other resources that we've posted to try to get accreditation or credit with their own institutions. If you happen to have a group of people watching at your location, each person can fill out and get their own feedback form, even if they didn't register individually. Please note today's session was recorded, and it will be available for on-demand playback. Just as Bill was highlighting some of the earlier sessions, we post and archive them all on a CLUIN archived webinar page. As registered participants, as soon as that archive is available, you will get an email from me. It usually takes us about 1 week, and that email will point you to the page where you can replay the session, access the materials and links, and even give us feedback based off of watching the recorded version. So if you think that this was helpful, feel free to share that archive link with colleagues. And with that, I want to echo the thanks to all of the presenters and organizers, as well as each of you for joining us on today's live broadcast. And we'll go